IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome to episode 34 of the Killing It,
Killing It
Podcast. So, a little different configuration. I think, Ryan, you look like you're in a hotel.
I am back at home.
I am back at home, which is nice. I'll be home for all the weeks except for one, I think. I've got one international show left of the year, but besides that, I'm at home.
Well, I am back at home. I got a good microphone this time. No construction work outside. No honking horns.
See, I'm the one with the construction. I don't think you'll hear it in my audio because we've all taken care of that. But they are tearing up the parking lot at my townhome, so I can't get out either. That's the other part.
Might as well be very productive today.
Exactly, busy at home.
I'm in Hermosa Beach right now, getting ready to fly out later today to London for a client gig, and out the window I can see the ocean. So that always makes it a good day.
Oh man, the ocean's always a good day. So I'm getting ready just before Thanksgiving, taking my daughter to Hawaii. So I'm going to be home for, you know, almost 2 weeks.
So it's like an eternity when we talk about it, like home for 2 weeks.
I did projects 2 weeks in Australia and then a week in New Jersey, New York. But I have all of my work clothes. I take them to the cleaners. So, you know, I one load of laundry, I'm done. I'm
good done, in and out.
Cool. So, you know, we've been trying to get people to connect to us on the social media. And so I guess this week I just want to ask, what's your favorite social media for, you know, communicating with people and so forth? For me, it's Facebook. I get to horse around and be as unprofessional as I choose. So people see the human side of me on Facebook.
I have such a love-hate. It's my favorite too. I have a love-hate relationship with Facebook. I love it in that I do actually feel like you get the most rounded version of me. I'm most comfortable in terms of like integrating the personal side with the business side there, where LinkedIn is pretty much just the business stuff. And Twitter tends to be just snippets in conversation, but Facebook's the most well-rounded. But the bit that really gets me is I just know that Facebook is also the one manipulating me the most from my perception, and that really does bother me. So I really do have this love-hate relationship with it.
Yeah, see, I would say that I spend more time reading around Facebook than I do the others, but I've gotten far more business out of LinkedIn than the others combined. And so I would say by far, that's my favorite. And plus, you know, there are groups, there are the news feed, and then it's very easy to have a one-on-one conversation. And I keep telling salespeople, you know, the one thing I pay attention to the most on LinkedIn is the, congratulate these people on getting a new job section, because every single time a good client gets a new job, hey, let's get the band back together again and see if we can't do what we did in the last case and do it all over again.
Yep. Quick tip for people who are new to LinkedIn. On Facebook, it's not acceptable to like your own stuff. On LinkedIn, you should. You should post something and then like it, because when you like it, it then gets spread out to everybody. Hey, there's been activity on your page. So
there's a pro tip.
There's a pro tip for you. Or some people would just say, Carl, it's time to shut up and go to topic one. So topic one. So just want to cover this briefly, but I do want to cover it. The story about Microsoft doing this study about a 4-day work week and having this, 40% increase in productivity. The first response I heard somebody say on social media was, well, obviously that can't apply to us. Question, is that true?
No, we'll always start with that. No, of course not. The difference there is first off, not everyone has to have the same 40-hour work or 4-day work week. That's right. Some of it too. Obviously, you have to design the way you staff your business based on the services that you are providing. If you are, however, providing something that is task-oriented more than time-oriented, you really can decide to do it that way. Shift work is shift work, but it doesn't have to be 5 days a week. It can be 4 days a week. It can be 4 10-hour days. It could be, you know, I mean, it can be, you know, spread out over 6 days. You can design it any way you want. You can really do it this way.
Yeah.
And Microsoft's not the first company to be exploring this idea. There's actually the whole companies that are, you know, IT organizations that are generally developing software more than delivering services, who are doing it, have made it a 4-day work week. That's part of their deal.
But see, that's the thing, right? Microsoft is the first mega company to really add some A, heft and credibility, and B, trackable metrics to the conversation, which I think is really valuable. I have seen and tried to consult on this topic for a number of years. It doesn't necessarily have to be just change it from 5 days to 4 days, but think creatively about the way you leverage your workforce. And especially in a world of remote access, let's take the time and place limitations out of how we run the business and try to put it back into, I need access to resources, I need expertise, I need output and accomplishment. Let's find a creative way to do that. I gotta say, I'm continually amazed, and not in a good way, with the managed service providers who sell to their own customers. I do work remotely and in whatever time frame is necessary, and then they 100% require all of their employees to show up from 8 to 5 every single day, and they are not allowed to work remote because we don't trust you if you're working remote. I'm like, wow.
One of the things that I always have pushed is what I call the golden hours. So the golden hours would be that if you had somebody come in an hour early or an hour late, you know, stay an hour late, you can be at work for the hour before your client gets there. So you can remote into all their machines, reboot anything that you need to, and not interfere with their work. But you'd also keep somebody within their 8-hour work week. If you had a 10-hour work day, you could have, and obviously this applies to people who have staff, right?
Right.
Have somebody who comes in, shoot at 6 o'clock in the morning, works 10 hours, and then somebody else who leaves at 8 o'clock at night works 10 hours. So you could do lots of work in the golden hours when your clients are not.
I want to be clear. The Microsoft 4-day work week was not that they did 4 10-hour days. There was literally saying, we're just going to have 4 days of regular work and we're going to see what that does. And they measured it based on sales productivity and saw a 40% uptick. What I'm just observing is that you can be very creative. My 4-day, 10-hour thing comes from living in the DC area. There's a lot of federal workers that move to that schedule during the summer in order to make a 4-day work week. That's just what they do.
Well, and it also speaks to the idea of what is it you're actually paying people to do? What is it you want from your employees? Do you want 40 hours or do you want more satisfied customers? Do you want to solve the problems that they're paying us to solve? Do you want a sales rep to produce more revenue at higher margin? If you get what you measure in this world, then let's measure the output, not the input. Let's measure the result, not the effort to get there. And if people are motivated, that not only will they try harder, and this is human psychology 101, right? If I feel respected, if I feel purpose, attachment, and if you give me flexibility, I will form not just an intellectual bond with you as my employer, but an emotional bond. I will try harder. I will stick around longer. I will do more work for a lower wage. It's just like, I think this is a time where our industry has matured to a point where we need to start thinking about human resources as a strategic asset, not just as a set of technical capabilities on a resume.
Well, the question is, if what I sell is time, I buy time, I add processes and procedures, and then I sell it to my clients. If I'm not going to 4x10, if I'm going to just a 4x8 instead of a 5x8, have I lost the ability to sell 8 hours worth of labor?
Well, you probably have because you're selling time, but you could sell results. You could sell, you know, you could sell based on, you know, amount of things, you know, uptime, or you could sell based on project deliverables. There's other ways of selling. Yeah. If you're trading time for money, you really do want to have the most inventory of that possible. By the way, I could solve that by going to a 7-day a week work week, but, cool. But, and that gets me way more assets, but can I hire people to do that? The counter argument to the time for money piece is maybe I have less inventory, but I charge more for it because my people are better. Yeah. I could go in a model where I only have 4x8, but my people are ninjas and they're the best. And they, you know, and they come in and they are paid the best because they also have a 3-day weekend every week and they are awesome. and I deliver that way. So it's all about thinking differently about the approach.
Well, and the reason that this topic is so germane to the audience listening right now, if you pay attention to the research, we do some, we work with a couple of other analysts to do some, what are the obstacles to growth for managed service providers, for systems integrators, for any solution provider business model? What are your obstacles? Is it market opportunity? Is it sales capability? Is it marketing effectiveness? In the last 5 years, every single time we or others that we work with have published research on that topic, number one on the list is the ability to find, hire, and retain quality human beings. Well, let's pay attention to why humans would want to show up here every single day, or at least 4 days a week, and make them want to come work for us. Yeah, I think you might be able to grow a little bit more effectively.
Yeah, I think we planted an idea here.
So exactly. All right. Excellent with that. Now, topic number two. I've just been speculating about whether or not we're hearing good advice from people who say, you know, just jump in and be an entrepreneur. And they give the examples of Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and people who, you know, dropped out, didn't go to school, became billionaires. Now, we've already discussed, we don't think dropping out of school is a good idea. But what about dropping out of work and going straight to being an entrepreneur? Because it seems to me that we're skipping the apprentice stage. How did you guys become entrepreneurs? Did you just like one day decide, I'm just going to do this job, and then you jumped in?
So I was pushed. I came out of school. I always like to say I came out with school with a computer science degree. I knew I was going to work with computers, and I started as a programmer, developer, consultant style person. And I actually ran a QA testing lab for a while, and I moved on to doing consulting with big Fortune 500 companies. And then I got offered a job doing what we would now call cloud services and a cloud, building a little startup. And I led a web team, and I was a product guy. And I was cranking out a new versions of the product for a while. And it was all startup style stuff, but I was a developer. You know, I led that team. And then on Valentine's Day of 2002, they laid off the entire development group in favor of keeping the sales guys to try and sell it to keep it alive. Now, looking back, you look and go, okay, that I get it. If you can sell some more, then you can rehire some developers, right?
You can get something to sell.
Right. And you've built something, go try and sell it some more. And what I learned that day was the people in charge have the golden parachutes and are the ones protected in the event things go wrong. Well, I can drive a company into a wall just as easily as they can. And that was my basic premise of going out and starting my own business, is that like, well, I'm capable of effing up just as easily as they are. So I'm going to try. And I freely admit that my stupid next decision was, well, infrastructure I can do. That's straightforward. I know how to do that because I've been doing it as part of being a developer for a long time. And I felt like that was easier than selling software, like trying to build new versions of software. In hindsight, I think I would slap myself around and say, Dave, it's way harder than you think it is. But that's how I built my managed services business and networked and connected. And I freely admit that I got both. You can say like luck is skill in being in the right place. My first managed services customer was for $14,000 a month.
Nice.
Right. It was a nice one to launch a business off of. That's how I started. I also look and go like, so then you know, I sold that business and I went back to being an employee, and I did that for vendors twice. And here I am launching another business, right? So I'm back out being an entrepreneur. And I now can look back and go, wow, I learned so much about running businesses over the course of not only running my own, but working with other solution providers, that my approach this time out is so totally different. I've learned a lot. So I'm new into the new gig, but we'll see how it all goes.
Yeah. See, and
your first transition to entrepreneurship.
See, and I would say if Dave said he was pushed, I would say I was pulled, right? I was in the consulting business. I was in the market analysis business. I was teaching other people how to build and operate businesses based on my history of growing up inside vendor organizations and learning not just marketing, not just sales, but also learning finance, operations, and human resources and other things like that. And it was finally shown to me, hey, by the way, those are skills that a person needs to run their own shop. You should probably put those things to use. It will, A, teach you more lessons, and B, give you much more credibility having done it yourself rather than just talking about how other people do it. And so that's what pulled me into the process years ago, right? And that was, you know, I used to be a partner in an ad agency, and then I became an employee of a big consulting firm. And then I decided, you know what, I've kind of seen this from the inside. Let's go do it again. I could not endorse Dave's comment more strenuously. Just because you know how to do the thing your business is about does not mean you know how to run a business. And that's fundamental. It's one of the taglines that I would use for the practice that we are currently focused on. Learn to run the business like a business. It's something that reverberates around our industry. And again, I think most of us and most of the people listening, probably students of the E-Myth as we have been over the years, and as he refers to it as a technician having an entrepreneurial seizure, just because you are really good at doing your thing does not mean you are prepared to go out and start a business doing that thing. Learn how to run a sales engine. Learn how to run human resources so you don't get sued. Learn how to run accounts receivable so you actually get paid. Oh, and by the way, the thing you're an expert in, it's probably actually the easiest thing to go out and hire another person to do for you.
Right.
Other things are the hard things to teach somebody your version of it.
How did you jump in, Carl? How was your first? Or
I would say it's sort of 60% by accident and 40% because I had the classic worst manager on earth. So I started, unlike starting, you know, Dave started with computer science. So I went to grad school in political science.
Ooh.
So, but I went to the University of Michigan primarily because it was a very technical focused school for the social sciences. They run all the big voting databases and so forth. And so it was huge. So I started with a VIC 20, and then I moved to a Commodore 64. And at U of M, I learned CPM and DOS, and of course, the University of Michigan's terminal system. And it just sort of grew from there. I loved the computer side of things. Eventually got a job taking political information and putting it online and selling subscriptions to it to lobbyists and state agencies, and running an HP 3000 and Novell system, and then converting that over to NT in the early 90s. So all of that was as kind of at the management level. And so I was gradually, almost accidentally, learning all of this technology along the way. And I loved it. And then I thought, well, you know what? My boss is the biggest jerk in the history of the world, so I can do this better. So I decided I'm going to go out on my own. And I thought what I would do is go to these state agencies and say, let me help you get even better, juicier, you know, reports out of this and more analysis and take it to the next level. And the first company that hired me as a consultant was HP to run their internal tech support at the Roseville plant in California. So suddenly I'm in charge of 7,000 computers on 5,000 desktops and the backup system and the Unix help desk. And it's like, okay. So I'm suddenly managing this big team. And I did that for a while, having one client at a time, and gradually decided I want to have more clients, right? So I decided I'll move to 4 days a week, 3 days a week, 2 days a week, and eventually added clients as I went along and grew into the kind of consultant that has multiple clients. So it was a very long transition, but I just want to emphasize that for me, the experience of having multiple experiences before I went on my own was huge.
Yeah. And
I learned to manage, and I did learn to how to make technology work. And I did learn that I don't have to know anything about technology to run a company.
You know, well, it's so totally true. It's interesting because I was, I was relatively younger when I started the managed services practice. But that I know that I spent a good portion of the early years of that learning to run the business. And I freely admit I was not good at that for a very long time. I don't even necessarily think that when I sold it, I was this genius expert of it. But I definitely was way better than I used to be. And I had learned a lot over time. And I think, so to answer your question is, do you need to have practice? It helps, definitely helps. Do you need it? No, but you better be open to learning. You better be open to learning on the job, because there's going to be a lot you don't know.
Well, I mean, but I'll actually go a step further and say, I think you do need practice before you go out on your own. I think that if you don't have that, the things you don't know are going to overwhelm you. And, you know, the statistics are alarming on the entrepreneurial side, right? Of all the new businesses that start up, half of them are bankrupt and gone within the first year. Of all the new restaurants that open up, and you know, something like 75% of them are bankrupt and gone within the first year. Those statistics aren't based on the fact that it's almost impossible to run a successful business. It's based on the fact that the individuals starting those businesses made mistakes that were preventable. And those things can be learned. Learning some, you don't have to, you know, have 25 years of experience before you go out on your own, but you do need to think about it from not just the point of view of what is this thing that we do, but how do we deliver the work? How do we sell the opportunities? How do we find the customers? How do we staff the business, run the finance side of things, et cetera? All of that comes into running a business. And if you don't know how that is unique to the business of technology, then, you know, you'll have, you know, what I always like to joke about, you'll be the most technically qualified professional hanging out at a Starbucks looking for his next gig.
Well, I think if you look at the books we read, the most cutting edge book on Windows NT 4.0 is irrelevant today. And the E-Myth Revisited is still the first book you should read.
It's eternal.
Still highly relevant. By the way, quick observation on the two of you. It's not an accident that the two of you are still doing what you do and thriving at it when both of you had an organic experience in things that are subscribed to. That was kind of your formative years in jobs and business. That is the way of the world going forward. And if people don't know how to get paid in subscriptions, whatever your expertise is, you're going to get left behind by the next economic wave. So a little word to the wise and self-proof point there.
Need to move on, but I will say that job was central to my view of the world in terms of business, because it was focused on subscriptions, and it was focused on providing content rather than just, technology that makes people type faster. Or
so you're way smarter than me. I just didn't want to chase a sales gig every month. I just wanted to know a check was coming in.
Well, I do like to say, you know, most of my success comes from being really, really lazy.
Oh, I'm totally lazy. But that's a whole, again, a whole topic for another day.
Recurring revenue is your friend.
All right. So topic number three. I want to touch on smart cities. So should I do the intro, or one of you guys want to?
No, go for it. Go for it.
All right. So I really enjoy this concept of smart cities, but I also, we were sort of talking before we started recording. Ryan had said, well, you know, you can have a smart computer, and you can have a smart desktop, and you can have a smart house, and, you know, all the way up to a smart city. So there's variations. And there's this description of smart cities that includes the following eight characteristics. So a smart city must have five of these eight characteristics: smart energy, smart building, smart mobility, smart healthcare, smart infrastructure, smart technology, smart governance and education, and smart citizens. So according to these criteria, they estimate that about 26 smart cities will exist worldwide in 2025, and only about 60% of them will be in the United States. So the question is this something that we should be paying attention to, or is all of that way bigger than what a quote-unquote MSP should be worried about?
Well, Ryan, shaking your head cannot be seen on an audio podcast.
I just realized no matter how strenuously I shake my head, the people won't know until I say it out loud. So my answer is, oh, no, that is nowhere near beyond the scope of a solution provider, because I work in that space every single day with people who are doing those kinds of things, right? Think of the example of smart governance multiplied by smart infrastructure. Surveillance cameras on light poles and telephone poles for license plate recognition and for public space surveillance and security, as well as in-car video in police cars and smart data terminals, et cetera, right? That is one of the legs of a smart city, and it is not for the vendor manufacturer to implement, because across the United States, as just one logical example, tens of thousands of cities need to A, consume that stuff, and B, actually manage that stuff with a successful implementation. And no matter how good the devices are from the manufacturers, they are not pre-integrated, they are not deployable, and they are not manageable. And oh, by the way, somebody needs to remember the data storage behind all of that stuff and the secure networking behind all of that stuff. That A, conceptually requires the participation of a solution provider, but it requires the participation of thousands of solution providers. It's not just like one big company is going to come in and sell, you know, the Microsoft $10 billion government contract for smart cities. That's not what we're looking for. It is pieces and parts integrated locally, and in all eight of those things. I mean, I geek out on it because I just think all eight of those pieces is potentially an entire business that then, once it's in place, somebody please monitor and manage that stuff remotely.
Well, so let me dive in on smart citizens, because this one jumped out to me right away as the easiest and most obvious area for smaller organizations to get involved, because smart citizens, in my mind, does not mean we're going to put a bunch of tech into people's bodies. What that means is that actually we have to have people who are capable of consuming these technologies, working with these technologies, and interacting with that. And that is called education. And by the way, the best people to deliver education in mass to the bulk of people that work in businesses, because the bulk of people that work in businesses work in small businesses, are the ones that can be focused on deliver at an SMB level, are technology providers focused on that space. You can make a ton of money in educating people on how to use this. And right there is your biggest opportunity. If I'm looking at that list saying, I'd focus on that. And by the way, I've got data there because it's more anecdotal than I like, but I'm digging into it more. But Carl, we were talking with, when we were down in Australia, AB Babichak did a presentation on the way she's been transforming her business. And she talked about the fact that one of her most profitable employees now is the person she's hired to do training. And that she does training on every single one of her, on all of the projects that she does, all of her engagements include a training component. And she's now going to be hiring more trainers to go into these organizations to enable the tech. And I look at that and say, this is right there. We've always talked about how do we make our customers better at this? Go work with them, go teach them, go get them involved in learning the technology.
And I think that when some people see smart citizens, they do think of, oh, we need more, you know, master's degrees and PhDs. But in fact, that's not it at all. The smart citizen, as you say, is using this technology to take something to the next level. Perfect example is AI, right? It's one thing to say, we have lots of data, we can analyze it. It's another thing to say, how do I improve people's lives by knowing that if they go and buy these things in this order over this period of time at Walmart, they actually have a disease that we can help them analyze. Right? That stuff is happening, but somebody has to be smart enough to know how to use this technology to come up with that conclusion.
Totally true.
And then, you know, again, smart citizens is not just the education of the individual, it's the information available to those individuals. So somebody, please go to the DMV in your local town and help them webify that database and put a web store front end on that thing so that I can renew my license without having to go.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm going to get a burrito delivered by a helicopter before there's a smart DMV.
So yeah, totally
that,
true.
That needs to happen, however. But I mean, you know, again, you see these things as, like, I read a story recently about in the Netherlands, a company is testing stretches of highways that are painted with two different materials. One of the materials is like a bioluminescent that allows all the lines to light up, so you don't need street lighting in order to make your streets drivable at night. But the second material is actually fiber and can conduct a signal, and therefore you can change the direction of the arrow as it's pointing based on traffic flow, or if there's an accident, you can pop up messages on the road. You know, that's a fantastic laboratory technology that now needs to be brought to the small town by you and implemented, integrated, monitored, managed by a local professional.
And you know, that's the kind of thing that probably came out of somebody just doing their job, not some great entrepreneur who said, let me tell you how we can change streets into smart streets, right? Yep. It was literally just what we would call a bureaucrat, you know, but I don't see that as a negative term. Somebody just doing their job who said, hey, we can apply this cool technology.
Yep. It's exactly like the example we had a couple of episodes ago about the Navy adopting drones for deliveries to submarines underway. It was somebody doing that job right now who said, oh my goodness, there's a better way. Let's apply this technology and figure it out. Now, those people need professional services. They need, because if you look at this again, you know, when you talk about the dimensions of a smart city, that's one thing. When you talk about the stack of technology, from the infrastructure to the developer tools to the applications to the edge devices to the data itself and the security and the management analytics, etc., of that data, the smart city thing has legs forever. And not only will you make money doing this thing, but you might actually improve your own quality of life and eliminate the line at the DMV.
Right. And I dug into just one. We could, there's more here. I mean, you could dig into smart infrastructure and what you can do at a small business level to help start enabling that. You know, there's areas around smart mobility. I mean, again, linked to education. I think there's, so to answer your core question, Carl, should people be paying attention to this? Yeah, please. Like, go make some money here. Cause the reason we're talking about it is we think there's opportunity here.
Right. Very cool. All right. Well, that's it. We're out of time. Looks like Dave's in the cold weather. We had this conversation offline. You're in the 30s or something, and I'm in
it's
80 today.
It's nice today, but it's going to, by the time this episode drops, it'll be getting cold.
Why are they paving when it's 36 degrees?
Because there's giant potholes in the parking lot, it is time to fix it.
It's what's called future-proofing the opportunity. It's what's guaranteeing that they need to do it again next year.
Exactly.
Very good. Cool. All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you for everything. That concludes episode 34 of the Killing It podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.